was always watching science fiction, horror, fantasy movies of the fantastic since I was a little kid. And when I was around 12, I bought an 8mm camera and started making my own films. And they kind of inevitably gravitated in that direction. I didn't really sort of come up with the idea for this movie as much as let it sort of simmer, because all of these science fiction and fantasy and, you know, bad B movies, all this stuff was in my head for years. And so it was sort of simmering. So the real question is, at what point did I sort of lift the lid on the stew pot and see what was in there? And the answer is, it was one night I was at the Pad of Guys. I was having a hard time sleeping. And for fans of the film, they probably won't believe this, but it's true. The first thing that came to me for the movie was the line, "Thrill me." I couldn't sleep, and I thought, a guy, he's two-fisted, he's tough. I don't know what he does, but he's sad, he's melancholy. I said, that'd be great. Let's have a scene with a nightmare. And he's awakened by the phone, and he grabs the phone, he snatches it up, and he says, "Thrill me." I said, okay, who is he? This is the middle of the night. This is my process at that time. Okay, who is he? Well, I thought, well, maybe he's a cop, because he's from the Raymond Chandler mode and sort of the two-fisted, cigarette-smoking, hard-drinking guy. Okay, so he's a cop. So then I had to figure out why he's being called, and, you know, clearly some kind of crime must have occurred. At that time, I was making a short film that was sort of going to be my entree, my director's showreel. And I had conceived these characters, these college kids, one of whom is sort of our hero nerd, and then there's his sidekick. And it was a science fiction piece. It was actually a time travel movie, a little short film. I ended up actually making 5 minutes of it. But I had these two characters, one of them was this sort of heartbroken college freshman who had a crush on this girl. And I said, okay, well, why don't I just take these two guys who became Chris and JC in Creeps and just put them into the movie. So whatever they did resulted in the cop being called. So now the story's sort of coming together. I have three characters. I have the cop, the detective, I have the nerd, I have the sidekick. And so we got to have a pretty girl. So the Cynthia character came into being. And then it was a matter, back to my stew analogy, of just taking all of the stuff that was in my head from movies that I'd loved as a kid to put into the stew. So I thought, okay, zombies. Can't beat zombies. So I knew it eventually there would be some shambling dead people. And I thought, space aliens, always works. Got to have some space aliens. So let's get some more pretty girls, have them take their clothes off. So it was that kind of like taking all of the B-movie crap and just throwing it all into the blender and hitting the puree button. And I wrote in about 2 weeks, actually.
What is this, a homicide or a bad B movie?
Fred Dicker, he's my motherfucking man. If he can't do it, no one can. Monster Squad, motherfucker!
Woo! Right. We're going on that.
Oh, shit.
Great. I don't have to put it in if you don't want.
I don't care.
Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have a very distinguished guest joining me today. He is the director of such films as Wrong Turn 2, Everly. He's got a new film coming out called Point Blank.
Yes.
Which will be on Netflix by the time this goes up.
Yes.
So people should watch that. They should also watch Mayhem, which I'm a big fan of.
100%. Yep.
And you are the co-host of the Movie Crypt podcast.
That I am.
This is Joe Lynch.
Hi, everybody. I am such a fan of this podcast. So that's the thing.
Warms my heart.
I love these formats, because if I didn't have you guys telling me about some of the movies that I don't think I would have known that they were doing a special edition of, or there was a re-release of. Like, I remember following you years ago, and you were the guy that was like, oh yeah, you know, like, I think we had a discussion about Cruising. Like,
that's very possible. I definitely followed you for a long time too.
So, and you like, but to have an intelligent conversation about that movie was why I liked Twitter. Sadly, that same conversation could get us both canceled, probably.
I suppose.
But it was still such a great way. Like, Twitter to me was such a connection, like a connector to other people, other cineasts, other cinephiles, other filmmakers,
yeah,
just fans in general, but that a place that we can all come and commiserate about you know, whether it's the new trans. At the time, I think 10 years ago, wasn't there a new version of Cruising?
I think so. I think there'd been a nice new DVD of it or something.
And fun fact, if you are a William Friedkin fan, now that the movie's come out, there is a huge, huge homage to William Friedkin. And by homage, I mean we literally name check him. We have clips from fucking Sorcerer in the movie and characters going, that's how you make a fucking movie. Not these lightsabers and shit. Friedkin, motherfucking Friedkin. That's in my movie. And I'm very proud of that.
Well, I am proud of you for doing that because Sorcerer Man, that movie. Here's
the crazy thing about Sorcerer is that it's still one of those movies that not enough people know about.
Absolutely not.
And so when I was writing the script for Point Blank with Adam Simon, we were doing a rewrite on it, and there's this one character named Big D, and on page, he reads like every other third act drug dealer that's been following everybody around a million, like you've seen him in a million movies, and it's a big reveal, and it's either a great stunt casting or it's just a, you know, cool actor, but you've seen that archetype before. And I'm like, well, how can we make him different? You know, like, and that was my goal with this entire movie was how can I subvert what you've normally seen in these movies? And some people might appreciate it. Some people might not. But look, you've never seen a car chase with a PT Cruiser. You've never seen a car wash fight scene. And I don't think you've ever had a third act character reveal where he absolutely loves cinema and he's got posters of Blowout and El Topo in the background.
Nice.
You know, but
nice.
But we needed something that would just be different. And I was watching Sorcerer. It was on, I can't remember what it was on, but you know, when Sorcerer comes on, it doesn't go off.
That's right.
It just doesn't. And it's weird how that movie is paced practically glacially. Yet it's riveting.
So
we wrote it in like, all right, here's this, you know, character who actually just loves movies, and everybody loves movies. It's a way of communication a lot of times, and it's a way people connect. So here's a character that uses cinema to connect. But then the more that we kept writing, and I'm like, fuck, we need this thing where like they need this character is used to create a diversion so that our heroes can get into the police station. And originally it was a riot scene, and there was no fucking way we were going to be able to do a riot scene effectively. And then Adam and I were bouncing ideas back and forth. I'm like, well, if Big D's involved, well, why doesn't Big D kind of get the chance to make his own little production? And we're like, well, what, like, we got to have something to kind of propel that. And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to write this in and let's just see when it gets killed. Let's have it where there's an entire scene where they're watching William Friedkin's Sorcerer.
Oh my gosh.
And Big D is providing commentary for that. Let's just see how far it passes. We have Gaumont, the production company. We have War Party, the production company. And we have Netflix. All of those, you know, those creative people will vet the thing. And then they'll either say cool or they'll say too expensive.
Yeah.
Shockingly, everybody loved it. Like Carnahan was like, this is fucking great. Like, fuck yes.
Well, that's awesome.
And I kept thinking, but I was like, all right. There's still going to be a moment where some producer is going to come up to me or someone's going to come up to me, some lawyer, and they're going to be like, well, you know, we tried, we crunched the numbers, we just couldn't afford Sorcerer, you know? I'm like, I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and then the day came where we were shooting it. I'm like, holy fuck, no one's come up to me and said, you can't use Sorcerer. Okay, fuck it, we're doing this. And next thing I know, I have this whole scene where Anthony Mackie and Frank Grillo and a bunch of these great local actors and Marquise Moore, who plays Big D, and they're between setups watching Sorcerer. Everyone is riveted. It was pouring outside, so no one could really go outside, and everyone else were just like, nah, man, just don't turn this shit off. I want to see what happens to the guy from Jaws. You know, I'm like, you got it, done. To have that element be part of Point Blank, you know, like for all intents and purposes, look, I was gun for hire, and I came in and I did the best job that I could. And knowing that there's like elements of that movie that are so like very much my input, I'm thrilled with that, you know.
Nice.
And to have a character like that talking about William Friedkin as a hero and having clips from Sorcerer, if just one person watches Sorcerer after Point Blank and hopefully goes, oh man, we should have gotten William Friedkin direct Point Blank, I will be very happy. I will be very happy. If anything, I'll just be happy if Friedkin watches it. You know, then goes, man, I should have fucking directed Point Blank. But anyway, enough about Point Blank.
Dude,
let's talk about one of my absolute favorite movies from the 80s. And you know what? I hate to even put the stigma of the 80s on there.
Sure.
Because what this movie represents to so many people, and I'm so glad that it's found a new life, you know, maybe 10, 12 years ago when that first release came out from Sony. But when that Blu-ray came out, it felt like everyone just rediscovered this movie again for the first time.
Yeah.
And what Fred Decker did with Night of the Creeps, I don't think will be matched. I don't. I really don't. I think there's something very special about this movie. Is this the part where you cut in the trailer?
This is
the,
yes. This
All
is
right, cue the trailer.
The night of the full moon is finally here for Chris, Cindy, and JC. It's going to be the best night of their lives. But tonight is also the night of the creeps. From a world unknown comes a nightmare unimagined. First, they are under you, around you, on you, and then inside you.
They get in through your mouth and you walk around while they incubate, even if you're dead.
They are a new breed of terror.
Freeze!
They are a different kind of horror.
We could have a little problem.
The creeps are taking over.
I got good news and bad news, girls.
What?
The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
You have never had a night like this. Night of the creeps. If you scream, you're dead.
There we go.
And we're back. Holy crap, what a fucking great trailer. Even if you only need to hear Tom Atkins say "thrill me" 14 times.
Oh yeah.
That's totally fine. But I want to ask you, when was the first time you saw this movie?
Wow, you're taking my lines. I don't care. The same thing.
You know I'm a fan, so I get to flip the switch.
Here. I appreciate it, dude. Let's see. I must have seen it on VHS back in
HBO Video?
Yes, yep. Definitely the HBO Video Box.
I remember like, oh shit, HBO's making videos now? Like, oh crap. This like, I thought it was like Prestige. I really did.
Oh, nice.
Because it was that, and like, I think they merged with like Thorn EMI.
Yep.
And that's where they did, oh God, Morons from Outer Space. It was like, oh, we got a hot lineup for you. Night of the Creeps, Morons from Outer Space. It's going to be huge.
Morons from Outer Space.
That's a hell of a double bill too.
Oh,
if you
it
think
is.
About it.
It definitely is. God, I haven't thought about that movie
but
in a
did
long
you,
time. But
did you feel the same way like that you do now about this movie? I know that's such a loaded question, but I remember watching this movie back same way on VHS, primed by Fangoria.
Oh, see, I didn't have that.
See, when and movies like and I've talked about this movie ad nauseum, Chuck Russell's The Blob.
Love
you
it.
Know, when you were a kid growing up, Fangoria was your Playboy, for splatterpunks. You know, where you could sit there and hold open, you know, the middle section, and you knew that that was the color section, and all of these beautifully detailed color photos of the most disgusting and disturbing shit you could ever look at. But once you kind of freeze frame it and you're not looking at it in 24 frames and it's not passing by you and it's not happening in real time, you're able to kind of look at it as a painting in a way.
As art.
Exactly. And that's why you would go, well, who did this art? You know, who did the effects for this movie, or who did the effects for those, you know, that movie? And then you treat them like Savini as your Picasso,
sure,
you know, in a way.
Absolutely.
And I distinctly remember movies like Evil Dead 2 and The Blob, and especially Night of the Creeps, or The Gate, where
yeah.
There would be these stills and the effects look so spectacular. And you sit there and you go, this must be the most disturbing movie of all time, because there's a shot of a guy that looks like a frat dude with his face completely torn off, but and out of context, you're sitting there going like, well, how long is it going to be on screen? 24 frames? 24 seconds? You don't know.
Yeah.
But you're looking at this thing going, man, I don't know what the fuck to expect. So here it is. You're looking at Fangoria and there's exploding headshots. There's a fucking corpse with an axe. There's aliens. What is this movie? And then, you know, you're reading more and more and everything. And you're like, I'm intrigued. And then the movie finally comes out. And, you know, where I grew up in Long Island, Night of the Creeps did not play in theaters.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
It did not. Like, the
it
closest
wasn't happening in Midwest where I was from either.
Exactly. Like, so our gateway to a lot of these movies was the mom and pop video store down the street.
Absolutely.
And man, I remember the day. It was a summer day. I specifically remember my mom going to the video store And I don't know why I didn't go. I think my cousins were over. And so we're like, while playing in the pool, my mom comes back and the shit-eating grin on her face, because she knew that she got, because, you know, like when you go to the video store, like especially back then where it's like, ah, the movie's not in yet. And there would be people who wait.
Just stand
to
there.
Wait for a copy to come in.
Yeah.
And my mom was gone for a long time. She waited.
Aww.
She waited for me.
That's adorable.
And she waited for Fred fucking Decker.
Wow.
So mom, now people might know this, but my mom took me to go see Dawn of the Dead when I was 2. She was a huge horror movie fan.
Awesome.
So it's all her fault, yep. So to speak.
That's
but I remember this movie coming home and it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was broad daylight and we threw it in after everyone had come out of the pool and my cousins were over and they were not horror movie fans. My mom, my brothers and I were huge fans. My cousins, not so much. About 20 minutes in, they were done.
Oh,
like
no.
The second that Paymer comes out, David Paymer comes out with that horrifying looking makeup when he's just
neck
walking down
or whatever.
When he's walking down the hallway and someone's like, good night, you know, good night, Ed. And then it's just this shot and the blood is there. And that shot is in Fangoria and it looks terrifying because, again, you're freeze framing on it. You're not looking at David Paymer with this gore on him for like 3 seconds. You're looking at it for as long as you want.
Yeah.
And it was disturbing. And my cousins were done. 20 minutes in and they were done. They were in the other room playing with fucking Transformers. And I remember this movie and I think I saw Return of the Living Dead before it, but it was another one of those movies where I didn't know whether to be scared or laugh. Like I wasn't given permission by the horror mores of the day to laugh at these movies. We're looking at Fangoria going, oh man, this is going to fuck me up on a Friday night sleepover. I can't wait. But we didn't know that there was the allowance of humor that we would like. And I look back and I go, Night of the Creeps is a very formidable film in my own kind of style or vision because I'm always, you know, depending on the product or the project, that's what it all is. Let's be honest. I wasn't that much of a Freudian slip, but whatever the project is, I tend to skew towards trying to find the levity and the fun factor in it, you know? Even with like Everly, where there were times, and look, it's not for everybody. Like I should have a t-shirt that just says tonal roller coaster on my chest, but those are the movies that I love. I don't like watching a movie that doesn't feel like it can't veer into comedy at times, or it can't veer into horror at times. Like I was just watching, Under the Silver Lake. Did you see it?
I loved it.
Dude.
Nice.
Oh my God. You're one of the few.
Nice.
Okay. You, me and Bret Easton Ellis are probably the only people that I know that fucking love this movie. But there's another movie that you can watch that and 20 minutes in, you have no clue what you're going to get because there was a scene that could have been right out of a screwball comedy. And then there's a scene that is as terrifying. The fucking naked lady with the owl's head crawling, like
creepy,
walking through the hallway.
Creepy as fuck. Yep.
David wasn't afraid of playing with tone. And I think it's a rarity. I think it's something that should happen more often. You know, story notwithstanding, like you got to make sure that it fits the story and the kind of movie you're making, but that's life.
Yeah, man.
Life can be a comedy in the morning and a horror movie at night. And, you know, Night of the Creeps for me was one of those first films that said, it's okay to laugh. Like, I don't think I enjoyed Reanimator until I watched Night of the Creeps.
Oh, very interesting.
It's true. I remember it specifically because I didn't know, like, I remember watching Reanimator the first time. And again, another Fango movie where it's like, this movie's not for me. Like, no, it is made for me because I'm a 9-year-old kid. And of course I love horror movies, but this is dirty. This is a dirty movie. this is a goddamn dirty movie. Not getting the humor at all. And you know what? To be honest, like I think anybody who watches that movie for the first time, I don't think you're primed for the humor. And you look at Night of the Creeps, and other than like the amazing tagline, which I had no clue was something that they just kind of like pushed in a reshoot.
I love that.
I love that. And we'll get to that because, man, if you're a fan of this fucking movie, this is as deep dive a disc as it gets. But that movie, Reanimator, even Evil Dead 2, other than the eyeballs, like, you know, the kind of human eyes in that skeleton, for all intents and purposes, you know that that's a scary movie, not a movie that has humor and levity in it. But that's where I think the brilliance of Night of the Creeps is that if you turn off the sound, it is not funny. Like, you can watch it visually, and I actually did that when I was watching the commentary again 2 weeks ago, which it's a fucking fantastic comedy.
Love it.
Commentary. It sucks that it's, like, the older one from the Sony one, because I'd heard it already, but there's so much that that Fred and Felcher did that. Yeah, that's right. That they talk about so many things in it that I was like, and I'll get to that. There's stuff that I was like, I can't believe I didn't realize that the alien in the beginning had the white eyes. How did I miss that?
I missed that too.
I've seen that so many fucking times. I've seen this movie so many fucking times, Brian.
Didn't click.
When he goes, oh yeah, and you know, not a lot of people notice, but you know, that alien is totally possessed. I'm like, oh, or he's got the aliens in him. I'm like, oh God! But that's why we have these, so that we can go back and watch them again for the first time, like James Cameron. But this is one of those films that I can look back and go, this movie affected me. That's why I was so excited when you said, like, do you want to talk about Night of the Creeps? I'm like, do I? I could look like we're, what, 20 minutes in? We haven't talked a fucking stitch about this movie at all.
No, it's that kind of movie, man. And it's the kind of movie that really left an impression on a lot of people and not enough people, ultimately, I think. But it is, like you say, gotten rediscovered and, and re-enjoyed. And this disc will hopefully blow the doors off for some people because it's fantastic.
Did you notice, other than the interviews, that because there's a lot of interviews from people that you wouldn't expect. You know, it's like, I never thought in a million years that I would need an interview with the coroner from Night of the Creeps, but his fucking anecdotes were great.
Yeah.
But other than like that, did you notice any seismic difference between the old Sony version and this one?
Well, you know, I didn't do an A to B sort of transfer comparison or anything, but I mean, I guess
you... Well, guess who did?
Oh, well, look at that.
I wouldn't say I did an A to B. I would say that I did a double eject comparison where I put in for the first 10 minutes of the movie, because if you watch Night of the Creeps, one of the things that I now see as a direct influence on my visual style is the opening scene with not the opening scene with the aliens, but the opening credit scene where it's the 1950s and it's black and white and it's gorgeously shot, but the credits are color.
I love that.
And it was such a bold choice. And I remember as a kid going, bold choice. Like, I was fucking 9 years old and I'm going like, that's a choice. I like it. Mm-hmm. But it not only made you appreciate the boldness of those like creep show type fonts, especially with like the blue and the red.
I love the color choice. It's awesome.
Such a great use of color. But it really made you appreciate the black and white and the nostalgia behind it and why Fred made those choices, even down to why Fred shot certain scenes the way he did. You know, I will never forget to this day the moment in the movie in the beginning when it's the slow tracking shot when the girlfriend is in the car and it's that slow reveal of the killer and he's slowly coming towards her, Johnny, and then the edit. And now, but it's one of those moments that I remember as a kid, forcing me to go, how did they do that?
Yeah.
Because there's no goddamn way that how many girls did they have on that set? That they must have shot this thing 3 or 4 times. They killed 3 girls before they got this take. Man, did they have to go back and reshoot all the stuff before? But in looking and like even back then, explicating it and seeing like, oh, wait a second, the guy's actually a little bit further back and it's something called forced perspective, and it makes you think that the axe is like coming down on her neck, but it's about 12 inches away. She's totally safe. But also the edit itself, how you can literally cut to the within a breath of that impact, and yet the audience thinks they saw it.
Yep.
You know, the old Texas Chainsaw trick.
Totally.
Where there is no blood in that fucking movie, and yet everyone thinks they see that it's a fucking splatter fest. But immediately at that point, I knew I was in good hands.
Yeah.
Like I knew that this was a filmmaker that knew his craft, loved cinema. The second you hear Romero, Carpenter, you're like, hey, this guy speaks my language. Like, but that's another reason why I fell in love with this movie so quickly was, oh wow, for the first time, I feel like I'm watching a movie made by one of my buddies. And I had no clue about the whole pad of guys. I had no clue that Fred Dekker and Shane Black were buddies. You know, you knew none of that, but there was a feeling.
Totally. Yeah, I had the same reaction to two things. One, the idea of shooting your movie first in black and white and then in color was just a choice that I hadn't seen very much, especially at the age I saw it. Mm-hmm. And then hearing those names, I'm like, oh, you can do that? You can just like blatantly call these characters by director's names? That's awesome.
I didn't know that either. I didn't know that you could be so in-jokey. Like, I remember, like, even as a kid, like, I remember hearing or even reading, like, that guy John Landis does a lot of, like, in-jokes. Like, in American Werewolf in London, there's tons of in-jokes in that. You know, see you next Wednesday. You know, so I appreciated that when a filmmaker was trying to say hello, you know, without being too blatant or being, like, Keenan Ivory Wayans or whatever, like, message, you know, like, he doesn't, or just anytime somebody breaks the fourth wall, you know, this was without breaking the fourth wall. Here's a filmmaker who's just kind of going like, guys, come here. I got to tell you this great story. But to go back to what you were saying before about the black and white and the color switch, I think it was even bolder that I think we've all seen plenty of movies that start with like a flashback scene and sure. then do 5 years later or whatever. And they start in black and white. TriStar Pictures, then go right into black and white. Here, no, you're in a fucking sci-fi movie.
That's right.
With little tiny aliens running through the through a fucking studio that you've seen in a million sci-fi Corman movies and stuff. But here, it's like, wait, I got this movie called Night of the Creeps, and there's a guy like looking like he's coming to the prom with zombie shit on. Where the fuck are these aliens coming from? So immediately you're like, I don't know. I can't trust this movie in the best way. Like, that's what I want. I want a movie that can make me uneasy, even if they're switching genres. But then you go into the black and white. You're like, again, where the fuck are we? Like, again, you're checking the box. Like, I don't see any black and white in this one. And then it goes into,
Pledge Week. Pledge Week. 1986. Oh, God. And it comes down. I love how it comes down.
Even the way
whatever.
That the titles roll down. You
love
know,
it.
There are just specific choices that I don't see very often that I completely appreciate. And in a movie that doesn't need to be as stylish as it is. You know, like, I've been watching so many 80s movies for a little research, and it really makes you appreciate when someone comes in and has the craft. And you listen to all these interviews that are on the disc, and even the commentary itself, it's like, it's very clear that Fred Decker is a born filmmaker.
Absolutely.
You know, and one that I think we all keep rooting for. You know, I mean, between this and then Monster Squad, to me, I was like, this motherfucker has all my money
yep.
forever. Mm-hmm. Like, if he just keeps making movies like this, and unfortunately, then I was the first person to go see RoboCop 3, because I'm like, wait a second, you're taking two of my favorite things of all time, Fred Decker and RoboCop, and you're smooshing them together? Wait, Rip Torn's in this too? Sold. Yeah, and it sucks because, fun little fact, so... A couple years ago, I was at one of the Masters of Horror dinners, and Fred showed up at one year, and I was so fucking psyched. It's like between him, the time that Chuck Russell showed up,
aww.
The time that Dario showed up and gave me a kiss on the cheek,
whoa,
and the first time that Quentin showed up, it was just like starstruck. You're just like, what the fuck am I here? I'm not a master of horror. I'm a masturbator of horror. I don't know what the hell's going on here. But Fred, I went up to him and he knew my work. So I was even like freaking out even more. So we got to talking. And at the time I was working on a TV, well, I don't say TV, but it was a serialized version sequel of RoboCop. It was called RoboCops. And it was, this was a pitch that brought to me, and they're like, what if we took RoboCop and Cops and put it together? And I wrote out, dude, this thing, I swear to God, I will sue the shit out of Neil Blomkamp if I see that thing and I see any of my shit in there. Because I worked on this thing for a year. I was so proud of it. I'm sorry we're going on tangents.
No,
so
I love tangents, man.
But at the time I was writing it, I saw Fred, and I remember, like, of course, you know, the debacle that the madness that he went through on RoboCop 3. And I kind of sidled up next to him. We started talking. I was like, yeah, so I'm working on this, you know, RoboCop thing. And immediately he was just like, ugh. You know, it's like, you just tell. He was just like, don't say that word. Trigger word, trigger. So I quickly just went into Monster Squad stuff and everything was fine.
Wow.
But, you know, he's just one of those filmmakers that I feel a connection to, in not just now because we're friends, more that here's a voice that speaks in the same frequency as I do. And I even think it now, like watching, if I were to make Night of the Creeps, whether it was back in 85 or God forbid there was a remake or whatever, I wouldn't do it because I would make this movie. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And the thing that I think works, and I'm so glad that it's out on this gorgeous transfer. So my point of this is I watched the first 10 minutes of, see, I bring it all back.
There we go.
I watched the first 10 minutes of this brand new Scream Factory. Now, is it Scream Factory or Shout Factory?
This is a Scream. Yeah, it's got a little on the side.
It's weird though, because because usually I'm so excited about the fancy new version. Of course I flipped it.
That's the best.
I always flip it.
No,
I always flip it when it's the I can't not get the original one, like from Cobra. No, there was a new one. I can't remember. Phantasm 2.
Yeah.
Like, I love that Phantasm 2 poster. The Scream Factory one is fine. Most of those, they're fine. But I love, like, Prince of Darkness. I want to see that shot of that green face that has absolutely nothing to do with the movie whatsoever, but it scared the shit out of me. I want to see that on my shelf, right?
I totally sympathize.
I watched the first 10 minutes. Gorgeous transfer. What I noticed the most that I was very impressed with on my dinky TV was blacks are really hard contrast-wise, especially with a movie that has night in the beginning. And I immediately noticed, and I'm sure there's going to be some people out there who's like, no, actually. But I noticed the blacks were so much cleaner and with a lot less noise on this version than the Sony version that came out about 10 years ago. So I can't, like, it doesn't say that it's a new transfer.
That's interesting.
But I could, I don't know. There was something about it I could tell. Because, and you can, if you own the old version on the Sony Blu-ray, I think you can tell, especially with the black and white scenes, because that's all you got, you know? So if you do have the Sony version, I would say this is still a worthy buy, not just for the transfer, but oh my God, the fucking interviews on this thing. All right. I'm sorry if I'm dominating this thing.
No, but, dude, this
like,
is great.
But again, like—
Love hearing you talk about this movie.
I love the new format that Shout / Scream is doing, where back in the day, 5 years ago, maybe. Back in my day, when we used to do special features on the Blu-rays and the DVDs and the laser discs, a lot of times it would be a culmination. You know, it would be kind of a bouillabaisse of all these different interviews kind of compiled, and it would have a through line, the origin story, the shooting, the reception, blah, blah, blah. Right? Yeah. There was a very familiar behind the music type format. Same structure, different band. In this case, it was same structure. In most cases, different interviews, different movie. But recently, it seems like Shout and Scream have been doing this, like, they single out all the interviews now, so you don't get, like, a big, long interview with everybody. You get a 10 to 15-minute interview with everybody, yeah. Like, everybody from Jason Lively and, you know, on down with the cast to the editor, you know, and it, like, The Burbs. The Burbs is a great disc because I really want to hear what the editor went through singled out. Like, I know what Joe went through. I've heard him tell the stories, but I want to hear what Marshall, the editor, went through when they didn't know how to end the fucking movie,
yeah. You
know? So to be able to spend the time with each of these artists, I think is a godsend. I think it's the sort of thing that in any other interview, all the stuff that they're talking about would have gotten cut out.
No, you're
don't
right.
You think?
Yeah,
you
know, I think so, totally, because they would focus on the filmmaker or someone else.
It would be
else.
The meat and potatoes. It wouldn't be all the fun anecdotes. You know that there's, you know, some producer or editor who's like, fuck, man, I don't know if we really need the story about the blowtorch, or I don't need to dwell on the rivalry between the bully and the boys, you know.
I love that stuff.
Have you noticed, though, like, this and Cobra, there's almost a Rashomon style to the interviews, because like in Cobra you have what's his name, the big main bad guy, David Patrick,
Brian Thompson,
yes where he rips into George Cosmatos,
yes,
rips into him,
yep,
and then you'll have another interview and then someone's really nice about him, or the guy in the beginning of Cobra, the guy at the supermarket,
yeah,
he has a whole nother side of it, yep. But then you listen to the commentary and it's, oh, everything was great. Mr. Stallone was so nice. And you're like, nah, it doesn't sound like it. That's what happened. But to have, look, every film, every movie that I've worked on, every movie that anybody's worked on, there's going to be 7 different stories.
Totally.
And you don't know which one is the one to listen to, but they're all everyone's stories, you know? So that's just different people's perspectives. And when you work on movies, there's a lot of people working on that. They're going to have a lot of perspectives. The director and the lead are going to have wildly different experiences than the transportation captain or the first AD or even the DP or the PAs that are on set. Everybody's got stories. So to be able to go back and to listen to, like, even, what's her name? Lisa, my notes suck right now, but here's this actress who also was in Weird Science, Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Oh, that's Suzanne Snyder.
That's it. Okay, yeah. Why did I say Lisa? Oh, because her name is Lisa in the movie.
Oh, nice. Idiot.
Well, anyway.
Yeah.
But Suzanne's interview is, I think, wildly wrong. Like, her facts are all over the place. But I love it. I love hearing that this is her version of the story.
This is the experience she had, and
exactly.
That's a small part of the movie.
And you have to cherish those, and you don't get those enough. And that's why I think, like, that new structure that Shout has applied to Night of the Creeps is essential, because – again, there are many stories and there's many interviews about Night of the Creeps, but not all of the stories are the above the line people. And it's like just hearing like how the bully, how he really bullied Jason Lively and the other actor. He was a real dick to them.
Yeah.
But then, and Jason talks about it. And it's funny because Jason Lively, who you also remember from like a European Vacation, he's very gracious about it. He's very nice about it. And like at one point he addresses the camera and says, "No, we're all good now, buddy. It's all good. But back then you were a real asshole." And 5 minutes later, you click on the bullies interview, which is very weirdly shot. It's like a different sound. Like yeah. It looks like somebody just went like, "Oh, you know what? We got a camera in the office. We'll shoot the guy and we'll send it in." Probably should have quality controlled that. But, but then he's like, "Well, I don't remember that, but sorry, guys." Like, it was this conversation back and forth between interviews on my fucking Blu-ray.
Yeah, man.
I love that.
Me too.
I would much rather that than some watered-down EPK that is giving me the bullet points, which I hate to say it, but that's a lot of special features, even retro special features on, you know, stuff from even Criterion, you know? While I loved the Blue Velvet disc, I kind of wish all those interviews with like the props master whose ear was the model for the ear in the movie. Like, I want to hear 10 minutes of that guy unfiltered. I don't need to be cutting back to other people. I want to hear his testimonial.
Quick side note. My buddy Bill Ackerman did a podcast. He does a podcast called Supporting Characters, which I love. It's great. Interviews bloggers, filmmakers, just critics, all kinds of good stuff. He also did a podcast called From the Neighborhood, where he went back and interviewed, I think he's only done about 4 episodes, but people from the crew of Blue Velvet, including the guy who made the fucking ear.
No.
He's one of the guys. I can't remember his name, but there's only 4 episodes. You got to check it out. From the Neighborhood, it's great. He's just talking to we're talking about different perspectives on movies. He's literally just talking to people in the crew and what their experience was with Blue Velvet.
That's great.
So anyway, but I totally agree with you. I think that is such a unique thing, and people forget always how much work goes into these things.
Yeah.
There's so goddamn many people.
Whether the movie ends up being good or bad, it still supported a lot of people, and they were probably saying better than digging ditches.
Yep.
And you're making something that, you know, whether you kind of see this global perspective, especially now, is seen around the world. Like last year when we were doing Point Blank and we were going over colors for the PT Cruiser, right? And I remember our transportation captain was like, "What about bright orange?" Right? And everyone went, "Actually," and then he showed us a couple swatches of it. And I'm like, "That is so ugly. Green light." But I remember the pride in his face, because he knew, and this guy's been working in movies for 30 years, right? That he made a very small choice that will be seen, well, at the time of this recording, around the world starting Friday. You know, not just in 10 screens, not just on VOD. When I was doing Mayhem, our props master, Ivana, amazing, like all these amazing artists in Serbia, I got to work with again after Everly. So it was great to get the band back together, right? And we were working on the props and we were doing designs for Samara's nail gun, right? Which ended up becoming kind of iconic. It's on the poster and everything. And the time that we spent on the model and the color, she killed herself to get this right color, because she then saw what Samara was wearing, her skin tone, kind of factored all of these things I would have never thought of in a million years. Yeah. I just went, "That one, why? It's closer to me." Like, that's it. Like, that was my reasoning behind it. That's not true, but it is. But the amount of effort that went into that, and then when I sent her the poster, the first poster, and she was like, "This is real?" I'm like, "Yeah." She's like, "My nail gun's on the poster?"
Aww.
Dude, it makes the heart swell.
Yeah.
So again, like thinking about the effort that everyone put into this movie, Night of the Creeps, that again, I don't think anyone expected it to be being talked about 30 years later, 35 years later. No, I'd say if you did a poll with most of these, you know, people, they probably went like, "What movie?" Or "It was a gig," you know. But when you get lucky enough to work on something that kind of, whether it hits the zeitgeist when it first comes out, or it slow burns its way into the cultural, you know, the cultural mores later on, doesn't matter. You did something that everyone's going to see. That you made a choice, whether it was on the day, in prep, whatever, that people love, you know, or that people at least acknowledge. You don't get to do that with every job.
Definitely not. Very few jobs, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to ask you, we kind of have been talking around things that make the movie stand out. Are there anything specifically that you remember the effects, obviously, you said?
Oh, dude. Okay.
Tom Atkins.
Well, we've been dancing around the Atkins. And now this special edition also has a super duper special edition where it has the Tom Atkins action figure,
yeah,
right?
Which I didn't get and I'm regretting.
Wait, you mean like they didn't send it to you?
No, they don't send that stuff.
Bitches. Cliff, come on, Cliff. Jesus, man. Like, give Brian a break. Look, I didn't appreciate Tom Atkins until this movie.
Zombies, exploding heads, creepy crawlies, and a date for the form. This is classic, Spanky. Classic.
Same here.
Because Tom Atkins was the guy in the Halloween movie no one liked at the time.
Yep.
I'm sorry to say that. You know?
No, it's the truth of the time.
But
now
at
we
that
know
time,
people love that movie.
Everybody rejected the shit out of that movie. Yep. And I didn't know The Fog very well. I knew it like, I might have seen it once. But I didn't appreciate it, you know, not until the Laserdisc came out and went, holy shit, this movie looks fucking wide as fuck. I love it.
Yeah.
You couldn't appreciate the ending shot of The Fog because the VHS version, I don't know if you remember this, the VHS version did a horrible pan and scan when Hal Holbrook gets killed.
Oh, my God.
Because it's that big swipe that Rob Bottin, the pirate, does. And it's, again, like the axe shot in Night of the Creeps. It knows exactly when to cut.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that the first time going, eh, then seeing on a Laserdisc going, holy crap, that's what it was supposed to look like? Oh my God. But again, I couldn't appreciate Tom Atkins. Then you see Night of the Creeps and you go, man, I don't know why I keep thinking about this word called film noir, but this guy's film noir as fuck. And it's that performance that he gives. It's, weirdly enough, it's the heart of the movie. And what's shocking to me still, I mean, I know we've been talking about the gore and we've been talking about the humor of and the craft of the movie, but what I love maybe the most out of this movie is the heart.
Yeah.
That you could have, you know, a character like JC, when you can have that character who in any other movie would be the comic relief, killed off pretty quick, you know, like, hey, we need another kill here and we need somebody that's going to raise the stakes, you know, for our hero. Fine, kill the cripple. But I specifically remember, God, oh my God, this is bringing back so many memories. I remember that moment when Chris goes into his apartment and goes into his dorm room and he plays the tape.
Oh, yeah.
Again, a moment in a movie that shouldn't be there because all the movies that we had been seeing up to that point, yeah, they're grindhouse movies. They're in, they're out, they're getting their cheap thrills and they're done. They don't pause the film for what's arguably one of the saddest scenes that I can remember from the 80s. Like, I think I cried as much during JC's death than I did with like Pet Sematary when Gage died. Like, it wrecked me. And it's hard, you know, I got to admit, I remember watching this the first time and it was hard for me to kind of come back into the movie. Because I was deeply affected by that kid because I could relate to both of them. They were me, you know, like there was no fucking way I would ever fucking rush a frat. No way. But those guys are doing it for me. Good. Go and do it. But I would hang, like, just seeing the accoutrements in their dorm room, that felt like a real dorm room. And then when, you know, when you hear the special features and you find out that it, like, yeah, that was like the smallest room in a warehouse that they were shooting at. But when he plays that tape, man, it is truly gut-wrenching. Yet, I don't think that scene would have been earned if Fred didn't do his due diligence, both with, you know, just setting up these characters as being as likable and as fallible as they are. I mean, that you know, is it Steve Marshall?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That character could have come off incredibly grating. And you know what? To some people, I'm sure he did at first.
Yeah.
But then you get the moment where... And that scene in the bathroom.
I was
going to
say, if we're talking about
intense.
Best scenes, it's still one of my favorite, you know, tension, you know, scenes in a horror movie. Mm-hmm. I just love it. And what you're saying about the tape, they play the scene out and I'm not hopefully you've seen the movie at this point.
Oh God, please! I hope you saw the movie.
But so you leave on a cliffhanger. What happened? Is he dead? What happened? And then we hear the tape, and we realize what's happened.
Even the way that they pitch down his voice.
Oh.
Where he's like, I think it's inside my head. Oh my God. It gives me chills just thinking about it. And again, it was a choice that elevates the movie. It completely elevates the movie because now not only are you sitting there and you're like, okay, aliens, check. Frat house bullshit, animal house style histrionics, check. Gore, check. Wait, emotional scene with pathos? That's not on my list. Check anyway, Like, you can't not appreciate that.
You were talking about Tom Atkins being the heart of it, and I think they touch on this in the commentary, but there is an underlying sense of melancholy to the movie, starting with him. I mean, he's a guy who's been through some heavy shit. He's been traumatized.
He's proto-Hopper.
Totally.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's bitching and moaning at the time that we're recording this. This is like a few days after Netflix announced that it got 40 million people watched it. Dude, I'll admit, I watched it at 7 a.m. on July 4th. I was up ready to go. I loved it. But I know there's a lot of people who are bitching and moaning about David Harbour's performance in the third season, how he's so angry and pissed off. I'm like, do you not remember the first scene of the first season where he's downing pills, he's a fucking wreck, he's two steps removed from Travis Bickle at this point.
I can't believe I didn't put this together until right now. My God.
But if you think about it, he is totally Tom Atkins.
Yeah.
It's just, and you just don't get the as fun. What Tom knows how to do is, make a one-liner out of any fucking line.
Thrill me. Thrill me. Thrill me. Thrill me. Thrill me.
Even, when you need a throw to a next scene, which, have you ever noticed that Fred does the same joke twice?
Oh.
The dead people don't just get up and start walking! Then you cut to
dead person walking.
He did that in Night of the Creeps. And in the Monster Squad.
Oh, yeah.
The same exact joke. Do I give a shit? Not a bit. Fucking bit.
One of my favorite cut-to jokes is in the opening scene in the car with the woman. She's listening to the radio, and they're saying that where the escape mental patient is, she flips on the car headlights, and it's like, you're there right now.
And it's like, what is it? Like, Corman University is like right down the street and stuff like that. It's like immediately you go like, oh, that's good. Like, you need that. But
anyway, I like his cut-to jokes.
Also, to go back to the bathroom scene, my wife, who I love dearly, still wears a Screaming Like Banshees t-shirt.
Oh, wow.
And that's why I will love her forever.
Aww.
Yet, whenever like one of my kids or somebody who comes over, whatever, is always like, what's that from? And I can watch her face where she's like, I want to say it the way that actor says it, but I don't want to be like canceled because like, I guess now it could be construed as slightly biased or slightly racist in a way, just the joke itself. But I can't help it, man. Can I say it once and no one's going to get mad at me?
Go for it once.
Oh, Screaming Like Banshees.
We nailed
it. Fucking hilarious because the actor himself keep saying it over and over again. I have that wonderful scene where they're in the interrogation room and then you can even tell that the cops are even in on the joke because they cut to him like, and? Oh, Screaming Like Banshees. And then later on, he's walking down the hallway laughing at his own joke. It's pretty fucking funny.
They even touch on that in the commentary. I think Felcher said something like, this guy really must not have a lot of humor in his life.
I know! He's laughing over a joke like that, It even reads like he was reading it from the script. Like the ad, like, you know what? Just do your thing. We're just going to walk with you down the hallway and just say whatever you want. And he was just like, that was a really funny line. I want to mention the effects in this movie are so fucking good. I was looking it up because I know that Kurtzman was on as a makeup artist and Berger, who's in the movie.
I think Kurtzman might be in the movie too.
Is he? Is he one of the frat guys?
I think so.
I wouldn't be surprised, but I know Berger's in there.
Definitely.
That's Mulletron 2000. That thing is gorgeous. But the effects in this movie are unreal. Like, that was another thing. Like when the janitor's head exploded, when you see it in the movie, it's 18 frames. I counted.
Oh.
Because it opens up and you're barely seeing it. And then JC closes the door again, and then the camera pushes in, and you go, and the music swells, and you're just like, oh, fuck, just like him. But in Fangoria, you open the page, and you're just staring at this guy's head, and it is wide the fuck open, and it looks like bolognese sauce has spilled all over the tiles. And it is harrowing looking. And again, it just, it was way gorier than it needed to be, but I appreciate it. You know, like the movie didn't, like, you could do a TV version of this and cut all the gore out and people would not mind. Actually, in fact, that's how I remember seeing it, like, a few years later, was it was on WPIX Channel 11 in New York. And it was a Saturday afternoon. And I'm like, fucking ace, Night of the Creeps is on. We're watching this shit. And we're watching it, and we're watching it, and everything is going great. And then the ending comes up, and all of a sudden, wait, did we just fade to black? And wait, where's the dog with the slug coming out of its mouth? Wait, what the fuck is going on here? This isn't Night of the Creeps. And, you know, this is well before the internet, and this is way before IMDb. So our resources to know that there was another ending to Night of the Creeps was pretty slim. I don't even remember reading it in Fango. Like, I remember discovering it for myself, and it blew my mind because I was always used to it. I think I was even hyping up to my friends who were watching it, like, oh man, wait until you see this part of the end with the dog. It's going to be great. And then all of a sudden you're getting this, like, way more silent, more meditative ending where, oh my God, Tom Atkins actually, like, lived, and now his spilled guts are spilling out into a cemetery. Oh, and then you go, oh shit. And it's a double whammy too, because you're like, oh shit, Tom Atkins. Oh shit, now the slugs are in a fucking cemetery like that. Oh shit, the spaceship's here. What the fuck, man? It is total kitchen sink filmmaking. I gotta ask, which version do you like?
I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you gotta go back to the one you saw originally. It's just hard to change that.
I appreciate it.
Me too.
And I will never forget watching that with my friends and going, oh my God, it's like a gift from the heavens. Any time that you would get a new ending, you'd be like, fucking A, sweet, you know? I just never expected that. And I totally see why they cut it.
Yeah.
You know, like, it totally makes sense. But that being said, I'm glad that this disc has both versions. I don't know if it necessarily warranted two discs.
Yeah.
Like, I'm all about green and carbon footprints and shit like that. And I'm going like, do we need two discs? All right. You know, I was actually curious about that. Like, was it the format itself? Was it like the 2K transfer that was so big that they had to split it up into two discs?
That's a good question.
Let's call Cliff and find out.
Let's do that.
But that being said, like, I find myself putting on the theatrical cut more.
Yeah.
Like, when I was going, all right, I got it. Like, let's watch this. I immediately went to the theatrical cut. I did, like you. It's like, I like that fine. Even if the effect is cheesy as shit, I still love that type of ending.
Me too.
You know,
endings are super hard to do. Oh, and damn. I think sometimes a good little joke ending is just the perfect thing for
sometimes you just need an exclamation point.
Exactly.
You don't need a dot, dot, dot. And the director's cut is a fantastic dot, dot, dot. You know, I would much rather, like, walk out of the theater and go like, what will happen next? Will the aliens, you know, touch down into the cemetery? Will there be an alien versus zombie war? Find out in Night of the Creeps 2. As opposed to, bitch just got eaten by a fucking dog alien. Like, that's just the ending. That's all you need. And that kind of punctuation is the kind of punctuation that you need on a Friday night where you got a bunch of kids screaming and yelling. So they go, yeah! Not, because the director's cut is a definite you know? Mm-hmm. But again, I'm so glad that it's out there, you know? In whatever form you want to watch it, you can watch it with the whole film, you can watch it as a deleted scene if you want, but it's there, and I'm glad it's there.
You know, another thing that I'm glad is in this movie, period, is the scene between Dick Miller and Tom Atkins.
Oh, God damn it.
My favorite fucking things in any 80s movie ever.
Like, so much, there's more gravitas that's thicker than gravy going in between those grates.
Hi, Walt.
Well, 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 Detective Ray Cameron, son of a gun, is that really you?
Yeah, it's me, all right, Walt. How's about you?
Hey, can't complain. Cannot complain, Raymond. Hiya, sport. That's a pretty fancy set of duds you got on there. What is it, Halloween or something, Ray? Did I miss something? Hey, kid, I'm only kidding. So, what can I do you for?
Well, the thing is, Walter, what I need is
You need your basic flamethrower.
Flamethrower? Flamethrower?
Yeah.
Flamethrower? Jesus. What's the matter? The old snub nose ain't good enough for you anymore?
I know. Just break out the old heavy artillery, will you, Walt?
One slingshot, one BB gun, and one flamethrower. There you go. By the way, you gotta watch out for this baby. Once you light the pilot, it goes out, and it plays hard to get like a son of a bitch.
Thanks.
So, if you just let me have the requisition.
Oh, well. The thing is, Walter, I don't have a requisition form, is the thing.
You don't? Well, geez. To tell you the truth, Ray, that could be a little problem.
Yeah.
There could be a little problem.
Oh, God damn it. Like, and again, I'm sure you saw the Dick Miller documentary,
loved
right?
It.
I've watched it 3 times now, and I find myself watching it because I want to hang out with an old buddy.
Yeah.
Now, I've only met Dick Miller once. He was at a Gremlin screening, and I'm like, how are you alive? Like, how the fuck are you alive, dude? Like, but still kicking, still having a blast, shaking everybody's hand, having a great time. So nice.
Yeah.
Such a nice dude. Curmudgeon-y as fuck, but that was his charm, you know? But he was one of those dudes in the 80s when you would watch movies and never expect him to come, you know, show up. It's not like you were looking at the Leonard Maltin book or TV Guide and it's like, ooh, a Dick Miller movie, you know? Very few times. Maybe, what, Theater of Blood, you know? Or no, Bucket of Blood.
Bucket of Blood, yeah.
Or
he's headlining,
you know,
yeah.
Maybe the original Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah, yeah.
But after that, like, Dick Miller was maybe, you know, fifth or sixth on the call sheet if he was lucky.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not a knock on him at all. He just liked to work and he took every part that he possibly could and made the best out of it. Every time he showed up, from Night of the Creeps to Terminator to The Burbs, you know,
Shopping
and any Joe Dante movie,
yeah,
I felt like I was hanging out with buddies.
Yeah.
And Dick was Uncle Dick, you know? Oh, you know what? You know, my buddy Joe's got this new movie, Interspace, or any one of those movies, you know, like, because Joe Dante movies, like Fred Decker movies, they were speaking in my wavelength, you know? There's the brown note, and then there's the Joe Lynch note, that's slightly above there. They're always at that frequency for
nice.
Me. And yeah, Dick was just one of those guys that you just felt like, oh, thank God he's here, you know? Because very much like Tom, very much like everybody in this movie, they don't have to be trying as hard as they do. And thank God they do, because we wouldn't be talking about this movie. We'd be talking about Spookies or some shit. I don't know. But thank God that they put that extra oomph into it, you know? And again, like, you can tell that there's a very specific reason why Dick Miller is there, is because Fred knows that he's the type of Easter egg. Like, that was right around the time in the 80s when people started hiring Dick, not because he was in a bunch of Corman movies and that was just the experience. It was, oh my God, it's that guy.
Yep.
And I need that guy. And in a movie that is just like saturated in jokes and movie nods, there's another one. The living embodiment of a movie Easter egg is Dick Miller.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just love the rapport that they have together in just a few minutes. You get a sense of like,
oh man,
they just have this relationship.
And the cut when Tom like kind of lays his cards out and you're just like, here comes the flamethrower. Now, did you know about the flamethrower before this disc?
In terms of
that it was real?
Oh, I assumed, but
I did not.
I had no clue.
Yeah. I thought there was complete Hollywood professionalism on that set. You don't have a fucking real flamethrower on a set like that. Like, that is as a kid, as a 12-year-old, I would have thought that was the most punk rock fucking thing in the world. All in for it. As a working filmmaker today, it terrified me. It fucking terrified me. Oh, not only did it terrify me on the fact that, yes, there is a flamethrower on the set. There's not only a flamethrower on the set, but you have an actor using the flamethrower. That is not, like, that is, that's absolutely terrifying.
And shooting it at other actors.
At other actors! Towards the camera! It's everywhere. It's like, dude, I've seen The Exterminator, and not even The Exterminator is doing any of the shit that's going on in this movie. And now the movie has this weirdly new sense of danger. Like, it's on the fucking box, too, you know? You're like, this they could have called this movie Night of the Blowtorch. And I probably would have seen it faster than Night of the Creeps, I think. Night of the Blowtorch sounds awesome.
It does, actually.
You know what? The editor also, like, there's some really great interviews, like we were
Michael
saying
Canu,
before.
The editor.
Yes. Who he even said he was randomly watching the movie on TV one day and he saw the new ending. Now, could you imagine being the editor of the movie and seeing a completely different version? Like, I guess they had to construct two versions of the film so that, you know, TriStar, who put it out, would have that extra ending. So somebody either screwed up or something happened and that director's cut became circulated. I'm curious. Is there anything other than the ending that's different with the director's cut?
I was going to ask you the same question. I'm not actually sure.
I don't think so. Because I've seen the movie multiple times and I can't for the life of me recall. And I'm usually good with that too. Like I know, well, actually there's about 18 frames in the third act on shot 24B. That's a slightly extended so that you feel the pathos of the exhale from Selma Hayek. No, it's not. No, I don't think there's any moments like that. But another scene. Sorry, we're jumping around, but
no,
I can't help it.
It's fine.
What's her name? The dorm lady who lives next door to the house mother.
Yeah.
That scene when the fucking killer comes through the floor is legitimately terrifying. And the scene when Tom, did you notice that there is a great story on the Blu-ray about Tom Atkins? Where there's this Steadicam shot that follows Tom as he pulls into the shot in his cool fucking Mr. Miyagi old school fucking, you know, roadster.
Mm-hmm.
He seriously stole that from Mr. Miyagi. You know it.
Straight on that line.
And it's a Steadicam shot. I think he even said it was like a Pantaglide, but it's a Steadicam type shot that's pulling back. And two things. One, during the shot, like Tom asks, like, "Can I smell a rose?" And Fred's like, "Yeah, fucking why not?" And that's the reason why he just went to go fucking smell. He went to smell the roses, but it's this long take through the sorority, and then it gets to the back alley where the killer is, and the way that it's constructed and the look on Tom Atkins' face when he's confronted with the guy that killed his girl 30 years ago. That is a moment where the visual style and the talent in front of the camera are in complete sync, because that walk feels like 3 hours long, and it should. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like there's a reason why you could have easily covered that from six different ways, you know, like easy tracking shot, close-ups, whatever. But the fact that Fred kept it long, I think instills a really cool sense of dread that you didn't think about until, you know, you forgot about because you haven't been thinking about the girl getting killed by the serial killer, but holy fuck, they brought it back.
I already killed you. You son of a bitch, I already killed you.
Another thing that I do want to mention, one of my favorite edits of maybe any movie, is the dream sequence. When Tom is walking towards the killer, and now this is the first time that we're in color,
yeah,
too.
Which is a nice touch.
Which a great touch, because I didn't know that car was like powder blue.
Yeah.
But it fucking hits you. And then the blood that's coming down the driver's side is red. Like that, it felt like a Technicolor nightmare. But the thing that is so fucking smart, and I don't think he talks about it on the commentary, and it's the sort of thing that I got to ask him if and when we hang out again, Fred, if you're listening, let's hang out. But at first, you know, like they have Tom playing like the younger version of himself. So he's got the young officers, he's got an actual police officer's outfit on. And the rest of the movie, you've been seeing him in a hard boiled trench coat and everything.
Yeah.
But here you're seeing him like as his younger self that we saw in the beginning of the film. And as we're seeing him walking towards the killer and the sound effect of the...
Oh, yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
Again, I was laughing 5 minutes ago, and now I'm terrified. How the fuck does this happen? But then it cuts to Tom, and he's holding the severed arm of the girl. And then it cuts back to his ascent, his point of view, if you will. And then it cuts back again to Tom, and now he's holding the shotgun. And it's one of those Coscarelli-esque dream logic things that didn't need to be in there. If anything, I'm sure he fought tooth and nail to keep that in too, because there's probably some executive at TriStar going, there's a serious continuity error here and we got to fix this now. No, actually, that was intentional. How is that intentional? It's a dream. The fuck are you doing? What, Decker, what the fuck, man? Get this movie done now! You know what I mean? Like, it's a choice that, again, did not need to... It doesn't thrust the story forward, but it made me feel more at home with this filmmaker telling me this story because he's doing it in a way that I didn't expect. And I would much rather that. I would much rather a filmmaker swing for the fences at any chance, because think about it. We're in a world now where cinema is being gentrified, where everything is becoming four quadrant. That's it. Like, if you want to make a profit, you got to make a movie that is going to appeal to everybody. You got to make a Times Square of 2019, whereas a lot of times filmmakers want to make the Times Square of 1981, you know, where it's rough around the edges, punk as fuck. It takes bold swings, probably stinks a little like piss, but like watching Under the Silver Lake, you know, I don't agree with, I didn't enjoy every choice he made, and sure, some things were a little wonky and stuff, but man, when he did it, he, like, I was blown away, because I'm like, wow, an animated sequence in the middle of this whole fucking movie, and now there's this old dude with really bad, like, or like really garish fucking makeup with these conspiracy theories. What the fuck is going on? A shot of a dude taking a shit, and then you cut to the shot of the shit? Man, if I was in A24 when that first cut played, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall on that one, you know? But again, it's things that you appreciate. So moments like that, or moments like in Night of the Creeps, when you have that very particular edit, I love that. I would much rather a filmmaker try to do weird shit like that and really play with the form of cinema than just getting it in the can and knowing that excessive amount of blood or a couple boobs was going to get you an opening weekend or a profit, you know, a profit margin. So, like, again, like, there's always something new every time I fucking watch this movie, you know? And what I love the most about just the fact that this movie is coming out again now is that the transfer looks so good that I don't think younger kids are going to, like, balk at it. Or like, they're going to look at it and go like, oh, this movie looks so good. Hopefully there's a lot of older brothers and sisters out there that are going to introduce or reintroduce, who knows, this movie to a younger generation. We need to get this movie out there.
Absolutely.
Because I just think that there's room for films, even whether they're old or new, that have fun in them. When was the last fun movie you saw?
I mean, it's tough, you know.
Probably, this is the part where you say, oh, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because I saw it before anybody else, right? Right? Is that the part?
That movie was hella fun, I gotta say. But actually, like, the Shaft remake, I thought was actually kind of
wow.
fun.
Wow. So, wait, hot take. Look, I haven't seen it, so I cannot pass judgment whatsoever.
But
God damn it, if you would have told me that a month ago, I would have fucking seen it.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I'm curious what you think when you get to it. I'm not trying to build it up, but it was a low expectation scenario, and my son and I went to see it. And
do you think that might have been part of it, though? Like, going in, going like, you know what, this movie's going to suck. And then, whoa, holy shit. You
definitely,
know?
Definitely was a factor. Expectation's always a factor, you know?
Yeah.
So it's tough. But to be fair, fun is not a general part of the movie going experience these days for me.
No, it's not.
You know,
and that's why, like, when I watch a movie like Night of the Creeps and I find myself equally unnerved, terrified, and laughing my ass off, I got everything I want from this movie, you know. To be fair also, like, I didn't go into Midsummer going like, here it comes, laugh right at summer, you know. But I was pleasantly surprised when I was finding myself laughing my ass off. I'm not going to say any more.
Okay.
But, sorry, spoiler alert, a lot funnier than you'd expect.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
But does that make you want to see the movie maybe a little more?
Tiny bit. Tiny bit it does, actually.
I think that there is room in, you know, in the content-saturated world that we live in, where you can have filmmakers, even like look at Nick Reffin, you know, taking 13 hours of Amazon's bandwidth and creating something that is equally terrifying, lackadaisical as fuck, and absolutely hilarious.
Another thing I have not yet seen, goddammit.
Dude,
I've heard.
I binged the entire fucking thing in like a day and a half. And it was glorious.
I've heard a few descriptions of a few bits, and I was like, I'm fucking in on this.
It's something that I also would, just to impart some advice, don't go, I'm just going to watch an episode here and an episode there. You won't be able to do it. It's like, you know what? First one's free, motherfucker. Here's a hit of crack. You know, here's a hit of reffin style crack. And but at the same time, it's daunting because each episode is like 70 to 90 minutes long. So they're like mini movies.
Wow.
I shouldn't even say that. They are movies.
Yeah.
There are movies that are coming out like this weekend, not mine, but this weekend that are like 80 minutes or 70 minutes long. And you're just like, okay, you know, you accept it now. But yeah, like anytime that we can get a film like Night of the Creeps, where it's a celebration of cinema, it's a love letter to the not just the horror genre, but to film noir, to sci-fi, crappy teen comedies of the 80s. Like
John Hughes has mentioned
John
as an influence.
John Hughes movies.
Decker himself says that, which is funny.
It hits so many boxes that you can't go wrong. And if you love the thing that I hope that when you guys are listening to this, you're probably listening to this going, I have Night of the Creeps already. I don't need to get another edition of it. But there's a reason why that's in your shelf. You know, like you must love this movie. So at the very least, support Fred, support Scream Factory and everything that they do by double dipping. This is a double dip worth dipping.
Absolutely.
Purely for the interviews alone. I think that like just knowing that, like I can't wait to watch the movie again. Purely to watch the coroner.
Yes, I was just thinking.
Now,
that.
I remember, though. I do remember the running gag of him always eating.
Yeah.
But I didn't know the story behind it.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it special. It's like, great. But that's what I love. Like, I want it. Like, whenever a new Scream Factory or Shout Factory comes out, like Cobra, for example, which your episode of Cobra might be even funnier than the movie itself.
That's all Brendan.
And fuck you, Brendan, because I don't have a fucking theremin-infused synth right now, and I don't have cool fucking Giorgio Moroder fucking synths either, so I'm just sitting here with my dick in my hand and talking about Night of the Creeps with Brian. So unfortunately, I'm not as funny, but I love what they do with the special features so much that I order it from Scream Factory directly, and I get it, and I watch all the special features first.
That's how you do it. That's cool.
My jam. Like, cool. Dude, I'm the guy that takes a Twix and eats all the caramel first and then the cookie. Like, I don't do both. I want, but the reason why is like with Cobra, I have seen that movie so many fucking times. You know, like I know it shot by shot. I can do that Roger Ebert thing where he's like, let's watch image 412 of Cobra. In this shot of Cobra, Marion Cabretti is looking off into the distance with his mirrored sunglasses. What does Camusso's mean? I can do that. But when you watch all of those interviews and you have those installed in your brain and then watch it again for the first time, fuck me, Jesus, dude. It's like a whole new movie, man.
It's really smart, actually. I'm surprised they don't fucking do that.
Look, you know, it's putting the cart before the horse if it's a movie that you haven't seen in a long time.
Which is usually the case for me.
Exactly. Like, yeah. A lot of times, you know, these are movies that I'm like, I did that recently with the Serpent in the Rainbow disc that they put out, that Scream Factory put out. I had not seen that movie in maybe 25 years. I love it, but I haven't seen it in 25 years. And watching the special edition first, all the special features and everything, weirdly enough, and not to sidebar this, but you saw the disc. You reviewed the disc, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
I thought you did.
I think I did.
Do you remember, like, they do all these on-camera interviews. Bill Pullman's the only one they don't do an on-camera. They do his voice only.
Oh.
And I'm sitting there going, like, how fucked up is Bill Pullman's face that they, like, the camera crew got there and he's like, nope, sorry, guys. Face for radio today. Like, not happening. I'm not putting my face on for you. Lone Star is out of commission. But you can record me. But those special features and all the interviews and everything, again, I barely remembered the movie when I saw it again. So I kept feeling like I was getting spoiled. I'm like, oh, that's right. He did die and get put in a coffin again. Fuck. Like, I wanted to re-experience that.
I think that's why I often don't do it, is because I have my memories of the movie,
yeah,
but then I have this fresh take on it that's me now reacting, mm-hmm, to it. Me, the dad, me, you know, the 40-plus-year-old man, like, reacting. That whole business, you know?
Plus, being a fellow dad, our time is short.
That's right.
So this I'm is not going to be able to ingest an entire film and then go, let me peruse through the special features too. No, I'm going, fuck, I got to either put the kid to bed or I got to get up for work the next day or whatever. Like, I can't invest three hours plus on all these special features. That's why I get the special features out of the way, so I'm like locked and loaded, so that I can watch this and go, oh, that's why that's there. Or, you know, look at this cool anecdote about the bully that I had no fucking clue about. Like, there's a great story about the bully in this. I'm not going to give too much away, but how it was like, what, the Toddster or something like that? The Bradster.
Yes.
How the Bradster was driving away after he drops Lisa off.
Yeah.
And how in actuality, like, they brought the car to set and everything, and they shot on a real campus. They shot on UCLA.
Yeah.
So to hear, like, Jason Lively was going to frat parties, and JC, like, Steve, was going to the frat parties across the street. How cool is that?
Yeah.
To not be going to school, but to be able to take advantage of the parties, and also probably to, like, hook up with someone to be like, oh, yeah, I'm making a movie across the street.
Exactly.
Oh, you like European Vacation? That's cool. Let's hook up. But to hear, like, the Bradster, how, like, he was all pompous and cocky and everything to everybody. Oh, sorry. He was method. Bullshit. He was a fucking dick, probably. But how he got in the car and was supposed to speed off, and it stalled.
Yes.
Oh, it's great. And that's that story. After you heard how he bullied, like, the you know, our buddies from the movie, I'm like, you know what? Serves you right, dick. Serves you right. But again, then you watch the movie and you go, oh, fuck you, Bradster. When he does drive off, I'm like, fuck you. Because if the camera turned literally 30 degrees, there's a bunch of drunk frat guys going, bullshit. Like, oh, it's mana. Cinematic mana.
Oh, good stuff. Well, I should wind this up, Joe, because I know we're
I'm so sorry. Oh, like, no. I feel terrible that we've been just jibber-jabbering
this
away.
This is great. Okay. This is exactly what I wanted. I just know we've got a hard out, and I don't want to keep you too long.
All good.
But yeah, this is just one of those movies that's so special to me, and it was really exciting when you... I mean, I'm not at all surprised that you're as big a fan as I am, but it's just one that was, I think, neglected in its time and definitely had a cult around it, but the cult has grown and grown.
It's the same feeling that I remember when like Eric Vespi spearheaded the kind of the resurgence of the Monster Squad, right? And when, like, that famous Alamo Drafthouse screening like 10 years ago, which was kind of what got the Blu-ray going, or the DVD at the time going, and now people truly love the Monster Squad. But I'm sure you can remember about 12, 13 years ago, you said Monster Squad. Most people said, huh?
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those movies that, like, you went, oh, wait, you know the Monster Squad? Okay, we're cool. You know? Yeah, it's totally. Right now, it's like, it's the Monster Squad was the Under the Silver Lake of its time. I'm sure Fred would not appreciate that comparison. But it was very much under beloved, or like underappreciated, and, you know, then became the biggest thing. I swear I thought that Night of the Creeps was going to enjoy a kind of a residual resurgence as well. And, you know, look, that Blu-ray came out, you know, like 10 years ago or whatever. And it's good. And, like, if anything, I remember, like, the creepy the slugs going across the menu and everything. It's like it was done well. But it still didn't feel like I could say Night of the Creeps and people would go, oh, like, I was up for this TV show recently, and I went in and I knew I didn't get the job the second I went, like, oh, yeah, you know, like Night of the Creeps. And
blank stares.
No one knew. Oh. No. Someone went, oh, you mean that movie Slither? And I'm like, I'm not going there. Going there at all. Nope. Not at all. But I was like, oh, fuck, I'm screwed. Because all my references and me saying, thrill me at the end, like, instead of hire me, I went, like, I'm walking out. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you, guys. I hope to, you know, hope people are working with you soon. And I walk out and I turn around and go, thrill me. And walked out. I kind of knew at that point I didn't get the job, you know. So, like, I'm thrilled that this new disc is out. I hope, you know, if you don't already own it, that you run out and get it, because it is, I can guarantee you, it is a hell of a night at the movies, even at home.
I really can't top that. So we're going to close this out, and I just want to say thanks, Joe, so much.
Dude, it was a long time coming. We've been trying to do this for a long time.
And I appreciate you.
I still have your copy of Used Cars, and we're going to get to that one, too.
It's all good, dude. We can talk about that at some point. I would love to, but I really appreciate this. And,
no, you know, my pleasure. Pleasure's all mine.
Great conversation.
Keep doing what you're doing, because we need it. It's a valuable resource. I think there's just so much stuff out there right now. And I don't think that there's enough of a spotlight on, you know, repertory discs, that repertory physical media, because it's so easy for, you know, anybody to put out an article, what's on Netflix this week? You know, like pot calling the kettle black here. Point blank, July 12th, Netflix. But you know what I mean? Like, there's not enough, because not everybody has the resources we do to be able to know that there's a new edition of Night of the Creeps out, or, you know, that there's a new edition of, like, New York Ripper in 4K coming out. Did you get that yet?
I did get it.
You did?
I didn't open it yet. That's how fucking shitty man. I am.
But. I'm kind of terrified.
Yeah.
Because that movie fucked me up when I saw it as a kid.
Yeah.
Quack, quack. And the nipples. So, like, thinking we had Bill Lustig on the show in January, and it was so fucking cool,
because awesome,
I'm writing a script right now where he's playing it. He's a character in it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's called Savage Neon, but it takes place in like 1980, and one of the characters is the assistant editor on Maniac.
Oh, that's cool.
It weaves that's its really way in there, cool. And I had to talk to him about it and just say, like, is it cool? He's like, of course, man, I don't give a shit. But then he was like, I'm just like, what are you working on? He's like, oh man, I got this like great new transfer of New York Ripper. And the second he said that, I swear to God, my butthole clenched, because I'm just like, New York Ripper, man. That's like, because that movie kind of goes way too far.
It does.
Like, it's classic Fulci.
Yeah.
But like, it's the slashiest slasher of all slashers, I think, and the sleaziest maybe
very
as
much
well.
The
and
sleaze.
Of all the sleaze core movies of like the 78 to 84, you know, like it out sleazes Abel Ferrara.
It's hard.
Actually, it out-sleazes Bill Lustig. Like, I think, like, and that the fact that Bill Lustig actually like brought it back is like a testament to how sleazy it is. But yeah, like, but again, we need you. We need, you know, like what you guys are doing, like at the New Beverly, being able to highlight these movies that again just don't get enough love. You're educating the masses in the best way possible, and I thank you for it.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I'm honored and flattered that you listen.
It's a yay,
big deal.
Well, hey.
It's a big deal.
Man, I'm on the 405 a lot. And hey, look, fucking 80s All Over is gone now, which is like, rest in peace. Well, like, I'm sorry, but yeah. But then again, well, now I have more time for yours. So, sorry, boys.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, John.
What are you doing next week?
I don't know yet. I got to figure that out.
Damn it. Thought I was going to get a spoiler. Shit. Well, hopefully New York Ripper. Well, no, seriously. Thank you for coming to Arioscope where we recorded. It was a pleasure to have you here. And thank you for the free copy of Night of the Creeps.
My pleasure.
Not that I wasn't going to buy it anyway.
No, my pleasure. I bought it. It's fine.
It's you know, totally worth it.
Yeah. Everybody go out and buy this disc. It's 100% worth it. It's one of the discs of the year for me so far.
Really?
Absolutely.
Whoa!
Just in terms of like, it's a great movie. It's the ultimate edition of this.
And it's,
you know what I mean?
It is the best version that you're going to get of it. You know?
Absolutely.
And if you have both, even better,
yeah.
Because then you're going to have all those great, like, somewhat retrospective interviews from back in like 2007, 2008.
I think all that stuff made it over, didn't it?
Some of it is, yeah. I don't
maybe
think all of it though.
Okay,
no,
right.
Not all of it.
Double check.
But right. Then you have all these great new interviews, and you get what is it? You get Decker's Hollywood Hallowed. I can never say it right.
Horrors Hallowed Grounds. Yes.
Which could also be a really great name for a coffee.
I agree.
But I've been watching Sean's stuff for years, and to see him do the Night of the Creeps version of it, oh man.
He doesn't usually do it with the actors in the movie.
No.
That's
no,
the thing.
That,
so
like,
so, people
so are, when the actors show up in it, I'm like, oh shit, special. It's like a very special episode.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with
that. Yeah, for those who don't know, Fred Decker and Jason Lively are both in this episode of Horrors Hallowed.
They look a little shell shocked too. Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah,
like,
it's great though. And just to listen to Fred talk, it's like another commentary. He's talking through certain scenes.
There's
and
stuff that he talks about in that he didn't talk about in the
absolutely.
Commentaries. That's valuable.
It's great. It's great. I love that stuff. But I really appreciate it, Joe. Thank you so
my
much.
My pleasure.
All right. Well,
I'll listen to you next week. I swear.
Everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray filled week, and we will talk to you very soon. Bye bye.
Throw me.
Nailed it.